Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunked. Today we have a very special guest, John Matonis from themonetaryfuture.blogspot.com. His blog is at the intersection of free banking, cryptography, and digital currency. And John, a little blip here on his blog about me, John Matonis, free market protagonist such as Matonis, regards cybercash as better than traditional government-issued or regulated money because it is determined by market forces and thus non-political in nature. Robert Gutman, professor of economics at Hofstra University in Cybercash, the Coming Era of Electronic Money, back in 2003. There's people writing about him, 1996, 1995, Seth Godin in Presenting Digital Cash. John is an Austrian school economist from George Washington University focused on expanding the circulation of non-political digital currencies. His career has included senior influential posts at Sumitomo Bank, Visa, VeriSign, and Hushmel. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's great to finally be here.
Yeah, super. We've been hopping to have you on for, since we started up the show. There's a lot of people that have been following your blog and in the chat rooms and the discussion forums, linking to your Twitter and your some of your past articles and following the posts that you put up from other people and that you write yourself. It's just right in there with everything that's going on. I just threw out some basic intro information. Before we fly in today, I know we're pretty much going to be sticking to the big hot issue of the day, this Bitcoin stuff, and a lot of the issues around it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into being interested in digital cash and your ideas on economics and these things in the history and how where you've come to this point in time where all of this is exploding.
Sure. I'd be glad to. It's an excellent radio program you have here, and I listen to it regularly.
Great, thanks.
I am a currency and precious metals trader by day, and I also advise companies and digital currency exchangers on things like jurisdiction and on Bitcoin integration. So there's a lot of new things going on in addition to the blog. But the way that I got into this was going back probably at Visa in the early 90s in the role of foreign exchange dealer for Visa. You get to see that Visa is really processing 150 different currencies every day. And they're exchanging those. The thing about it is that all 150 of those currencies are all national political currencies. I put a proposal forward to them in the early 90s to integrate a non-political type currency unit into the Visa clearing system, because for them it's just adding another unit, because their systems already treat them as various units.
Right.
So there's really no reason that they had to be political, and that's why I took that approach. I could see clearly that it was not going to go anywhere in the bankster run world of Visa. So
right.
I relegated myself to writing about it while still working at Visa, and that eventually led to an opportunity at VeriSign, which was at the time just spinning out from RSA. Data security. Visa was one of the original investors into VeriSign, actually in the very first round or in the seed round. So I moved over with the Visa investment, and at that time VeriSign was still called Digital Certificates International, DCI. And, you know, the first thing we sold was that we turned around and sold the SET protocol implementation back into Visa.
Okay.
And as we all know, SET as a protocol had only about an 18-month lifespan, but things were moving so fast, and it was really an educational process of teaching financial institutions about public key cryptography. I mean, the world from that angle in the early 90s was just shifting over from symmetric key encryption to asymmetric encryption.
Right.
And nobody really got it. So It was incredible. It was, we were going over to large clearing organizations like SWIFT in Belgium, and we were presenting internet clearing, internet payment systems to these guys at SWIFT. And, those were fast times. There were a lot of deals to be done, and we were laying the groundwork for, the online banking that everybody uses now for bill payment and checking your balances.
Oh, that's great.
So what I wanted to point out on that really is that, VeriSign did very well, obviously, and that led to, after an educational role with financial institutions, I was responsible for the sales and marketing to financial organizations for Visa. So I had the financial services vertical, which covered brokers and payment clearing associations and the banks. I eventually went on to Hushmail, which was in Ireland at the time. And the reason that Hushmail was in Ireland, now they're in Vancouver, Canada, but they were in Ireland because it was against the law to export strong encryption from the U.S.
Right.
And we had to hire non-U.S. developers. So we looked around and we said, there's the three I's. You can do Ireland, India, or Israel, and we picked Ireland. And we had non-U.S. developers. We had about a staff of 150 people, and
wow.
The world is we were going full blast, ready to do the Hotmail path.
Yeah.
But then 9/11 hit, and everybody in the venture capital world kind of pulled back what they were doing for almost 2 years, and we were very close to some significant term sheets at that point. Hush then later, Hush later went to Vancouver, where they're operating now, and they're profitable, profitable at a much smaller scale, which is a good thing, and it's a good service. So I would still recommend the service. The world, though, is happy with naked email. So it's kind of hard to convince the world that, at least the non-crypto libertarian world, that we need a strong encryption on email. It's funny how people, they don't like sending postcards, but essentially a naked email is like sending a postcard.
Right. Yeah. Well, one thing on that is a lot of people are using crypto in ways that they're not even aware of. So it's better for developers to try to build strong crypto and anonymous or privacy preserving technologies into the protocols and into the software, so people aren't having to learn it and use some of the complicated concepts on top, have it built in good, engineered from the bottom up, and then it's used more than trying to get people to understand what PGP is. Instead it's a something to put it in, like Bitcoin, all that crypto that's going on with Bitcoin, people just, you know, load it up and are they sending stuff back and forth, not actually thinking about, you know, needing to hash something, you know, so.
Right, right, right. How are you going to get your mom and grandmom to use Bitcoin? And you know, it's got to be easy enough at that level. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, go ahead and continue. Sorry to interrupt. So
I was pretty much done on that. There are some funny things about Bitcoin that I wanted to bring up though, since that's the hot topic du jour. It's funny when you're reading things, don't you think, in the blogs and on the forums that, you know, people take this position of, well, I don't really believe in Bitcoin or I don't support it. It's some kind of a Ponzi scheme. And, you know, I could say that about the U.S. dollar. I mean, I don't really support the U.S. dollar, but I'm still going to take them when people give them to me.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going to happen to these Bitcoin skeptics and naysayers. I mean, are they going to turn down a Bitcoin transfer when somebody pays them that way? You don't have to love a payment method to use the currency.
Yeah, I saw you made that comment to Ben Lowry in the thread. You actually asked him directly if he would.
Right. He never answered me though. But you know, you have to. It's going to prove itself through the traction that it gains.
Well, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's the thing. When I first heard of it, my first response was sort of knee jerk, but it only until I saw the merchant list, and this was only basically over a few days, and I saw that there were people that were actually accepting it, and for goods and services, and at that point, then. You know, I may not have been a believer in the long-term viability of it. It didn't matter to me. All that mattered was it was solid enough and being used by people right now. And one example I would get of that is that there's a lot of people out there who accept Western Union payments for their, you know, to pay for goods and services. They'll accept that as payment. So if I may not think that the dollar is as worthless as toilet paper. Okay, fine. I got physical dollars in my hand. And I want to get the goods of service from these people. Now, I don't have to believe that Western Union or MoneyGram is a system of rock solid value where I want to put my money into it. It can be a system that I just use. I go, I give them the money, and I trust that while the transfer is taking place and until that person goes and picks it up, you know, that the whole thing is going to work. And so I don't believe that Western Union bucks, if that's what you want to call it, you kind of like go and you make a deposit at Western Union into their account, and then the other person goes and makes a withdrawal. You know, I don't trust Western Union as a banking money institution. But if it's something that works, then, wow, we're talking about something that is possibly very powerful. And this goes for all the Huala systems around the world also, is you don't necessarily have to trust people for a long-term storage thing. Now, if you're speculating on Bitcoin and like that Falkridge guy from the Pirate Party, he's taking his entire right. life savings and putting it into it. That's a different thing. So at the very smallest level, you can't, like you said, you can't criticize Bitcoin if people are accepting it all over the world any more than you could criticize and say, oh, Western Union is, they're a bunch of garbage, you know? No. They're They're great. Well, I mean,
do you really think that the average European sat down and was in favor of the ECB coming out with the euro? I mean, I'm sure they resisted it as much as they could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact is that it came and they use it. The difference with Bitcoin being, of course, that you know, Bitcoin is not essentially dictated from above. It's actually organically growing from the bottom up. So I would think more and more people would be attuned to that, rather than having it be essentially pushed down from above.
Mm-hmm. Well, you brought up something in that response that you did, where timing is everything, where And these guys were discussing some of the stuff on the technology that's been there. Some of the technology that makes up Bitcoin is essentially, it's nothing special or new. It's just a combination of ideas and things. And I think that one of the, if you're wondering how come we haven't had Bitcoin, or how come there's some things that we may want that we're not going to see right now, because it seems like some solutions are coming out as almost side effects of other implementations of other things. So you may have guys out there that are have been trying for many years to come up with the perfect money transfer system, the perfect value transfer system, not necessarily for money, but to exchange stuff back and forth. Or they're trying to come up with the perfect digital cash system for doing banking. And while they're focusing on those things, Bitcoin comes along and has all this really strange, weird stuff that, if you sat down, it's almost like if you tried to sit down and create the perfect hammer, you wouldn't actually get it. In the Bitcoin thing, it's like this guy came up with this big contraption, and it never necessarily was specifically designed to be a hammer, but it takes care of all of the problems that a hammer is a solution to. I know that he spent a lot of time specifically going into it, but if you look at how in these articles by the Gorn and by Nick Szabo, and in your right. article, it goes into this, how this is a really, it's almost a harebrained system that you wouldn't think could be possible, and it solves all these problems.
What do you think, though? What do you think is the reason why things have changed in the last 10 to 15 years? I mean, if you had to put your finger on it.
Which things?
Well, just the general atmosphere in in Userville, out in the economy. Why is something like Bitcoin getting traction now when other versions of digital cash and even digital bearer certificates did not?
I know
my answer, but I was just wondering what your thoughts were on it.
Oh, well, man, there's a lot of things. But, I think one thing that is very closely tied to this is you could ask the same question about another topic, two specific topics, and that is the Federal Reserve and Ron Paul. A few mm-hmm. years ago, 10 years ago, when I tried to talk to people about the Federal Reserve, they would look at me as I was a nut, and they said this couldn't be possible, that how it was formed and the whole history and how it works now. Just a couple of years ago, telling people that it was a private institution, not even part of the government, they many times just wouldn't believe you. And then, this whole thing with Ron Paul, it's like 10 years ago, these ideas that he's bringing up and talking about, it was only in very small circles. Now it's mainstream. So I think that things have happened over the past several years where with this latest banking, the banking crisis and the economic stuff, where people are very much aware more than ever about the scams that are going on, the fraud, the insider games, how the revolving doors of all of the military industrial complex and then the bankers and Wall Street and the White House, how these guys just are, they're all the same people. And now they're starting to feel it, and they're listening to this stuff, and they're ripe now. I have people that I talk to about agorist type ideas, creating alternative social and economic and business systems to a lot of the existing ones out there now. And before, they may think, oh, you're crazy, but now they realize that many of the institutions that they have relied on have failed them or are failing them now. They're not actually functioning for them, so they're looking for alternatives. So you mix that all up with this past year with what happened with WikiLeaks, okay? WikiLeaks was one of this first one of these first disruptive technology things that's starting to come head on with the state. And all these people are like, wow, look at the government starting to crack down. And they froze their PayPal account. They froze their bank account over in Switzerland. And then all that anger and resentment of bankers was already there. And then it got taken to the next level. And that's why, you know, when Bitcoin started taking off at the end of last year, the forums were just flaming with people saying, no, it's time for us to do this another way. So this whole timing thing, I think that even if Bitcoin came out 5 years ago, it may not have actually, it may have maintained the same calendar growth, even if it was fully active 5 years ago, as it has now. Because it seems like these events and these memes and the power behind them and the exponential growth of them has and the U.S. Just one last thing, and the U.S. like seizing domain names without due process.
Right.
You know, all that stuff ties into these ideas and the growth of it's like every day, bam, 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 something else, and so people are jumping on this like never before. So.
I think all those are absolutely valid reasons and things coming together at once. But also you have to consider, you know, aside from the distributed architecture and the peer-to-peer technology that's widely available now, I think people have just become so desperate for any kind of retaining any kind of personal privacy or financial privacy. And also so desperate for being able to do transactions online that aren't subject to reversibility or chargeback.
Mm-hmm.
I bet you there's a lot of people out there that don't realize PayPal has up to 60 days to reverse a transaction. I mean, I hear about more people having PayPal accounts frozen than I do about people saying good things about PayPal. And, you know, PayPal being the de facto leader, that's what a lot of individuals have come to know. But it really, really is a not that good of a payment system for the types of transactions that I think people are becoming more and more desperate for.
Yeah.
In the world of financial privacy. People don't realize how quickly they give up their financial privacy without even thinking about it. And I mentioned this on another show is... money was never intended to track identity. A form of payment should not necessarily track your identity, but everyone's fallen into the trap of thinking that that's a legitimate use. We have to catch these pornographers, and we have to catch these terrorists and these drug dealers, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse that come out, and that's what's used to justify it. So that's why people are okay. They say, well, I'll give up some of my financial privacy because it means we're catching the bad guys. Well, you know, the bottom line on this is that secrecy doesn't equal concealment. Secrecy equals privacy. And you have to look at it in that way.
Yeah. No, those are fantastic points. Now you have the internet and the way that people are interconnecting together now is greater than ever. India, just a few months ago, had the government shut down PayPal or blocked it, and countries are blocking it even though it doesn't offer much in terms of privacy. But what they're doing is they're blocking it because they're realizing that huge numbers of their people in those countries are moving over to these alternative systems. And PayPal... For a central bank, PayPal in a third world country, PayPal is an alternative system that they're not necessarily integrated into monitoring yet. So they've put in these little controls and making sure that they have their licenses and the government has whatever backdoor access to the transactions that are happening. But a lot of these, what's happening is that these governments are realizing, and they saw this with eGold also. Remember with eGold, there was the people in, I think, Iran and a couple other places that were using eGold to do business, individuals, okay? Individuals,
right,
who are free, sovereign men, regardless of who is above them claiming jurisdiction over them, doing regular business, like regular people in Main Street USA doing business with E-Gold, and then E-Gold gets a court order, and all these guys get their E-Gold seized. So
Right. So think if we don't do something like this, though, if we don't do something like Bitcoin, the people, for instance, in Hitler's Germany, when the Jews were trying to preserve any amount of wealth that they had in order to leave the country and avoid confiscation. I mean, under the OECD FATF rules, the Jews moving their money to Austria would be considered technical money launderers. And all they were trying to do was preserve their wealth from confiscation.
Right.
So, you know, we don't want to go. We have to think very, very carefully before we go to an environment where the task of going digital has been a step backwards in what it means for our financial privacy and transaction anonymity, transaction irreversibility, because that's not a better world. If it goes into the fully traceable, more efficient systems for tracking, it's actually going to be a worse world than just regular paper cash.
Right.
And I always make that analogy is with $50 bills or $100 bills, people don't regularly consider you a criminal because you pay for your groceries with a $100 bill. So if you were to use the same type of a bearer instrument online, the equivalent, you know, the feature equivalent of a $100 paper bill, but online, which I think is, probably 10 bitcoins now. You know, if you were to use that, you know, pretty soon people will be labeled criminals because they're using, you know, semi-anonymous bitcoins, you know, keeping in mind that what we all know about the Block Explorer and how you can trace Bitcoin. It still is better, infinitely better than the other centralized systems that are out there where the transition to digital, you know, may not end up so well. It reminds me, I think I posted this too about a couple months back, but Sweden is making a lot of progress to going towards a fully cashless society, and they, you know, they brag about that like it's some kind of a good thing. We're going to do everything on mobile, no more paper cash, and we're going to be super efficient and you know, great shining star of the world. But what they're really entering into is a more traceable lack of financial privacy nightmare. And that's the balance here. And so it is a battle and it's a war, and Bitcoin is in the vanguard of that.
Well, we may see that the very act of them doing that, and was it Sweden you said?
Sweden is the one that publicized it. Yeah.
What's wrong with those these legislators over there? Sweden is this really strange situation. You know, the very act of adopting that and the enforcement of it. Do you know whether there's whether they're going toward a cashless system that is by decree, like where cash is illegal, or are they just moving to where the national monetary exchange system is? You know, where they're not going to be having bills.
No, it's the former, and they tout it as a benefit because you're going to be getting away from these messy coins and paper things, and we're going to go mobile. We're going to go, you know, fully electronic, and you know, and yay for us, this is all a good thing. But you know, you have to understand it. I guess living in Sweden is that they, since the majority of them vote for the nanny state and the welfare state, they probably do want more efficient tax collection. And you know, the dynamics, the voting dynamics have already shifted there, where greater than 50% of the voters are receiving assistance and subsidies from the state. So they're always going to vote themselves in to power more people that can accomplish that. It's, you know, in some countries, you have up to 80% taxation.
Right. Well,
so that, you know, they want the more efficiency. They think that people who are doing you know, out of system gray economy transactions are part of the state's revenue problem.
Right.
Uh-huh. And it's exactly right. I mean, you know, you can get into the whole gray economy thing, which I'd like to do, you know, related to the Bitcoin economic theme.
Well, it seems to me that if you do go to this cashless system, in inside of a society where it's, you know, the sun's out and there's flowers every day and every abundance is flowing and all that, okay, fine. But those systems are not sustainable in the long run and usually not even in the medium run. And so they start to implode upon themselves. And when that starts to happen, then people are going to start to be more desperate to hold on to what they have because there's not enough that's going around. And at that moment, then you tend to see more black markets start to explode. So in any system where you have a I don't know if there's a law for this, but let's say, for example, in the U.S., there was no interest in any type of BitTorrent-type system until Napster was prosecuted and shut down.
So Right. It evolves to suit the environment.
Right. So the harder that these countries – moving to a cashless society may actually be the one of the best things that can happen for – not necessarily for some of the people. But if you look at technology growth, the biggest competitor right now to Bitcoin is not – PayPal. The biggest competitor to Bitcoin is physical dollars, cash. Okay?
Right. Absolutely.
So, and that system is all, it's all supported and propped up and manipulated.
And it's under attack too. They're beginning to phase out the 500 euro note, in Europe.
Right.
And, you can still find them and you can still get them, but it's getting to be a pretty rare and elusive thing, like the unicorn.
Yeah, so what are they trying to do?
The 500 euro note, people have just taken the approach that it's only used by a certain segment of society and most people don't need it. And, you know, if you think about it, though, a 500 euro note is about, it's like carrying around a $700 bill. It represents a lot of money.
Right, but on the Max Kaiser show you did the other day, you held up a USB stick talking about having, like 80,000, I forget what you said.
100,000. Yeah, make it 200,000.
It doesn't, I mean, how big of a number can you hold on a USB stick? I find it interesting. A lot of people look at what's happening with the NSA, Big Brother, and all these institutions and initiatives worldwide, and they have this paranoid idea that there's this big superpower out there that's all-knowing. But the reaction that I see to a lot of this disruptive technology is completely asinine. It doesn't make any sense to me. I can see them going and seizing the Bernard von Notthaus's for the Liberty Dollar, all is gold,
right.
You know, seizing the e-gold. But it's like it's such old school to just go and grab a big chunk of gold. It's just old school thuggery. But you see the responses that they have to WikiLeaks and some of these other things. And is that the best thing you can come up with? Is like kill the guy or take his servers and shut him down? You know, it seems like so many of these people that are involved at high levels, and I don't know if it's just that idiots are at the top, but there's really smart people behind them that actually do have more plans. I know there's a lot of intelligent people out there who understand all this stuff very well, working for intelligence agencies and the like, but it just seems to me that there are very few people in the world right now at all, let alone in any positions of power or even rising to near any positions of power, that really have any idea about what's going on right now and what's happening with this technology.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin will slowly get on the radar of governments. You mentioned attacking payment systems, though, and that's exactly what happened with the recent poker case where the three U.S. online poker sites were shut down. And I think half the guys are still at large, but they did not attack the sites. They attacked the method of payment, and they attacked the banks and the payment processor. So in a lot of ways, it's like, you know, how the U.S. got Al Capone was on taxes and tax evasion, not for the other thing he was doing. And I think you'll start to see increasingly the payment systems become a target of prosecution and enforcement, because just like in the copyright P2P world, there's really nothing else left to target. And for the Bitcoin world, that means targeting the exchanger infrastructure, where those guys are basically, you know, hanging out to dry, because that's where the rubber meets the road in converting things into political currencies in and out of Bitcoin. You know, so the thumb drive, USB stick, that's only important and relevant if I desire to get my Bitcoin converted into a political currency on the other end. I'm going to have to go through an exchanger at some point in the ecosystem there.
Right. Now, let's touch on that with the old ecosystem with the exchangers. I mean, in order to move, the exchangers typically worked with the old currencies in order to move stuff in and out of the digital currencies. So there's very few of these that were out there. There's right now, there's, I don't know, do you have any idea of how many exchangers are operating doing Liberty Reserve and PEC Unix and
Yes, I've looked at that. I've looked at that, and the blog tries to follow that, you know, to the extent that we can. But in an informal count, I estimate there's roughly 2,000 worldwide.
Okay.
And that number is going to surprise a lot of people. But the reason that it is really at that level is there's so many out there that you don't know about, and there's so many out there that are already localized and regionalized for the local market that they're serving. So take, for instance, the Baltic states. You know, you probably have three or four operating in Lithuania, Estonia, and then you have exchangers operating in Latvia, and all of these countries where they're doing specialized services that kind of population is demanding, because first of all, they want it to be in their language. They want the customer support to be in their language, mm-hmm. and they want the interface with some of their banks, or if not their banks, then some of the other payment systems. Like a large one in Russia that you know about is Web Money.
Right.
And they have some very good traction, but you know, the more that they grow, they become more and more establishment. And that's how you get to 2,000. And that's a good thing. That's what you want. You want to have this distributed approach, because it's going to be impossible to shut down 2,000 exchangers.
Yes.
And, you know, I predict there's going to be 4,000 exchangers. So the ones that are in at the most risk are probably the ones that are operating in the jurisdictions where the jurisdictions will be the most aggressive. And those are the leaders of the OECD Financial Action Task Force, and the AML anti-money laundering crowd is going to come down hard on exchangers that are operating in those type of political jurisdictions. For instance, the U.S. or Canada, or the U.K., France, Germany, those types of areas are probably not going to be your first choice for setting up a currency exchanger.
Right. Yes. Have you seen the article that hit the web yesterday? Underground website lets you buy any drug imaginable.
I did yeah. See that. And
okay.
You know, that was funny. Go ahead.
I just went to Google to see what the search results are, and it returned 541,000 results for that phrase. Yesterday in the evening, I did that, and it was around 400 something thousand. You know, this thing, it hasn't caught much attention, but it's all it's going to take is a few things like these articles like this to hit at the right time, and then, you know, it's all over Fox News, and, you know, it gets turned into one of these, one of these buzz points that somebody starts bringing up, and it's going to be on the cover of Time magazine. It could be, like, in a week, it could be a month. But it's coming soon. And what's interesting about it is that what we saw with the WikiLeaks was the government's response to it was pretty much impotence. And the more that the threats came out about, well, let's kill these guys and we got to stop this, there was an explosion of BitTorrent activity on the internet. And people all over the world said, no one's shutting this down. I'm going to be part of it. And they just joined in with the torrent exchange and mirroring and all this stuff. And then it seemed like it probably was a wise thing for them to do. The government kind of backed off. It was like they realized, wait a second, the harder we crush down on this, the worse that we're making it for, the faster the information is actually exchanging between people. So it's like,
exactly,
you know, it's like the longer they take to do anything about, to try to do anything about this, the more it'll be too late. But the harder and the stronger and the more fierce that they try to crack down on this right now, the worse that it's going to be by actually a much worse measure. Because I'm not looking at this from an aspect of something. I mean, I have my own feelings and opinions and things that I want for, that I feel are necessary for liberty and other stuff. But if you back up and look at this from the perspective of, you know, it's not about what I want or what I think should be. It's about what's there and how can you stop it? What are you going to do? And they don't have much that they can do right now when they go after this.
Right. I mean, we can at some point, I guess, talk about the vulnerability of MTGOX, where 97% of the exchange value occurs. I mean, there is an element of vulnerability there to the system, but that ties into some other things. I just wanted to take a second and comment on your point about the drug article and how that's going to go mainstream and be on the cover of Time. I absolutely agree with you, and if it's not this particular story, it'll be some other story, predictive markets or things along those lines. And, you know, it touched a nerve in people, and you could tell from the number of Google results that you got. It touched a nerve both ways, where, you know, people see it as, the coming of the apocalypse, and other people are cheering for it. But I think there was a person on Twitter that commented about it that made, I think, the point in a very succinct way, because I actually disagreed with it at first, but I didn't really know what he was trying to say. It was that, Bitcoin users are trying to develop a money and a currency. We're not trying to develop a drug barter scheme. And, you know, the point is that nobody should care what you're spending your bitcoins on. We don't care what people necessarily spend their $100 bills on. It's none of our business. So it gets to the point of, like you said, warping the idea of drug use into something that is, you know, a Bitcoin's main reason for existence. Well, you know, the Silk Road drug dealer firm, they also use the telephone and they also use the mail. So are you going to talk to the telephone executives, and are you going to blame the mail and other people? Like, we all use the telephone and we all use mail. Mm-hmm. But so do all the terrorists and the drug dealers and the pornographers. Mm-hmm. You're not going to stop that.
Yes.
And it's incorrect to attack the money system or the payment method. And we need people that are in these future time articles to start emphasizing why it's a different issue, and it's not the payment system that's at fault.
Yes, correct. Yeah, that is.
So that's what we got to get out there.
Yeah. There was a thing that is related to the whole drug system. Is let's say that the government goes and decides to, let's just talk worst case scenario. You said that there's 2,000 or so in a particular survey. You have exchanges out there, and you predict 4,000. Well, I predict millions, okay? Because what's going to happen is that if the government decides to just stand back and let people be free, then, you know, there may be less than 2,000, because there may not be really that much of a need for that many, because everyone, you know, can just exchange these things freely with a couple of them, and they're not getting, mm-hmm. you know, shut down. It's not centralized. I mean how many systems are out there for international transfer now? Let's see, MoneyGram, Western Union, okay, there's two. So in a system that they would crack down on, let's say that they went ahead and said, okay, all Bitcoin exchanges are illegal. Bitcoin is illegal. Possession of a Bitcoin is illegal. Possession of a certain amount of Bitcoin is considered an intent to deal, and the penalties are harder. You see where I'm going with this? You could take all the laws out there and the entire infrastructure of all laws and enforcement agencies and all the money, the billions, tens, hundreds of billions, trillions over the years put out toward this whole war on drugs. And you could go in there and just do a search and replace for illegal substances and do a search replace for and do Bitcoin. And now you have a whole parallel system. Let's say we just clone the entire system. We have an entire Bitcoin, anti-Bitcoin, oath that's the war on Bitcoin. Okay. It's a parallel system to what's out there now. Now, at that point, you could say that who would exchange Bitcoin at that point? Well, every drug dealer. Every person.
When zeros and ones are outlawed, then only outlaws will use zeros and ones.
Right. So then what's that going to mean for the infrastructure and distribution system of Bitcoin? Well, if the Bitcoin infrastructure in any way at all resembled right now the entire infrastructure of the drug distribution system worldwide, I mean, we're talking a system, I don't know, what? A million times larger or more and more dense and more interactive. And then you're talking about the fact that these same dealers, and when I say dealer, I'm not just talking about some guy that's on the street corner. I'm talking about a guy that he's the guy who sells to his friends in the dorm at the university. Okay.
Right.
Your regular type of guy who buy their dime bags and stuff from all over the world. Regular, nonviolent, regular guys. These people, they'll be selling a product at that point without having to worry about being having possession of anything, because they just take, someone says, hey, I have so much money in this. Who do I get my Bitcoin from, or cash it in or cash it out? I need Bitcoin. I want to buy this. Okay, boom. You go to your local dorm or your classroom. That's what one of our guests said. Inside of your classroom, you know a guy who has cash. He'll give you dollars for your Bitcoin. And he'll give you Bitcoin for your dollars. So, I mean, anybody can...
So every person becomes an exchanger.
Exactly,
then.
Exactly. Yeah. If you know anyone who has it, and here's the incentive. Here's the incentive. The incentive is that there's an exchange fee, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So your guy that's selling dime bags is usually not making that much by the time he's out there selling these things. He's just got a little bit more than an exchange fee that he's making on these things. Now, I mean,
That's happening in college dorm rooms today.
Right.
That's probably happening right now. They'll bring the laptop into a room and, they'll do the Bitcoin thing and there you go. That's a physical presence model.
There you go. I mean, so if you start cracking down on these exchangers, then all of a sudden you've done the same thing when you crack down on any type of a large distribution system of pharmaceuticals. You create a higher incentive level. All of a sudden, therefore, since it's illegal for me to go down and just use a free market thing where my exchanges are, I'm only going to have to pay 1% to get money in and out of the Bitcoin system, I may have to pay 10 or 15%, and it may well be well worth that, okay, in a truly 100% anonymous global money distribution and transfer system, it may be worth 15% easy, okay? And push, the harder they crack down, the more that they have created an incentive for people to actually be exchangers at the P2P level. So
They're exchangers and they don't even realize that that's what they're doing.
Right. So
yeah.
I that's my point in bringing that up, is thinking of a worst case scenario where they think that we can cut it off here and we can shut it down here and we can do this and that. And they're really, pushing on a rope or what,
pushing on a string.
Yeah, pushing on a string. you can, you know, you just extrapolate this, and it's it looks like there may be a lot of blood along the way, but there's not really going to be any type of a war that's won in any type of way anytime soon from anyone.
Right. That's why. Hey, that's why it's a great time to be alive, and and I'm glad I'm not missing it. I think it is. It's going to evolve to the point in our lifetime where we are going to see that make or break moment on things. Anyway, you reminded me of a site when you mentioned the size of the economy. I want to give my friend's site a plug here. It's bitcoinwatch.com, and they actually have the size of the Bitcoin economy there, which is updated in real time. I mean, it's simply the market cap of the calculated Bitcoin outstanding times the current exchange rate in various countries. And I checked, last time I checked, it was like $64, $65 million. Is the entire size of the Bitcoin economy. It's only going to be a short matter of time before that reaches 1 billion. And I think when that happens, you probably will see it on the cover of Time or Forbes magazine. Because people will be talking about, you know, Bitcoin economy reaching 1 billion. And that's still a relatively large, or still a relatively small number when you consider GDP numbers in various countries. And when you consider how much of actual GDP is in the underground or gray economy. I can give you some statistics on that too, which is why I think this entire thing is going to be so fascinating over the next 3 to 4 years. For instance, in the U.S., you know, there's only about 6 or 7% of overall production and revenue and economic activity that is off the grid or unreported. So use that as a benchmark, you know, the 5, 6, 7%. And, you know, the U.S. does a pretty good job at being efficient in things like that compared to the other countries. You know, other countries, though, like, I'm not going to pick on anyone in particular, but, you know, staying out of the third world where I think it's over 50%, let's just look at some of the European welfare states. You know, Italy, estimates range 30 to 50% of economic activity that occurs in the gray area. Same can be said of Spain. Countries like France, probably, you know, 15 to 20%.
Greece.
And Greece is another example. I mean, you know, people don't even know, but I've heard offline that, you know, 95% of the doctors in Greece don't pay any income tax.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's accepted, and it's a cultural thing. So if it's not getting reported and it's not being included in these actual numbers, I believe that the entire total amount of the calculated gray economy worldwide is what is potentially available to Bitcoin in the near term. And it's not just because it's underground that it's available to Bitcoin, but that's what it's cutting into. It's cutting into that gray economy that for no other alternative has to use nation state currencies.
Yeah, right.
You know? And just think if that started to slowly migrate. I mean, what do you think the total size of the gray economy worldwide is?
Yeah, exactly.
And so before Bitcoin chips away at nation state reserve currencies that are on the grid, it has to chip away at the gray economy value that is currently off the grid, because that's where Bitcoin's features and attributes are most suitable.
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's a difference, though, between talking about looking at the market value of the market price of the number of Bitcoins out there and what the price is happening on the exchange. That statistic is almost a little bit closer toward giving a statistic on how much gold is actually out there and held in certain hands, and multiplying that times the current price of gold, because almost an M3 type of a thing with the quantity, and then trying to value that toward another currency, like looking, well, what's M3 in the U.S., and then what is that in euro? Because if you're talking about the amount of activity, you're talking about the velocity of exchanges happening within a certain amount of time, regardless of how much currency exists there. So,
well, the statistics for average daily turnover are on the Bitcoin Watch site as well. I just I'm taking a look at it right now. So in the last 24 hours, there were 426,000 Bitcoin that were sent. Okay. And that's an average of 18,000 Bitcoin per hour. So if you take a $10 exchange rate, it's $180,000 worth of Bitcoin that are sent every hour. I mean, still a relatively small number, but it's measuring the activity, and this is in real time. So that's why I put it out there for people to keep an eye on. Oh wow, it's up to 77,000 now for the size of the economy, and just yesterday it was 77 million, and just yesterday it was 65 million. So a lot of that's attributable to the exchange rate, which, as we're speaking, is at 12. So
wow. You know,
you're doing a timely show here.
Yeah. You know, I did an interesting, what's that Google search compare thing that you can put in a couple of terms? It's a Google fight, or I don't know what it's called. You put in two terms.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, it shows a graph. I loaded up a chart on the dollar value to Bitcoin. And then a chart showing, Google Trends, a Google trend of Bitcoin mentions on the web. And it's kind of interesting to see how close, I don't know if it's a, that there's causation or correlation or what here, but you can kind of see the popularity of Bitcoin as a search term in Google Trends, very close to the actual dollar value, the graphical representation on the chart.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
You know, so let's see. Oh, so one of the things I was going to bring up is that right now, because of the non-anonymity of the Bitcoin blockchain and the transactions, you're putting up those charts, and we're seeing these exchanges happening. But a lot of people don't realize how non-anonymous they are. And right now, it's kind of a free-for-all Wild West out there, because no one really cares about what's happening. But as you start to see governments start to crack down, or people start to be a little more concerned and realizing, hey, wait a second, you know, this isn't Linden dollars that are just flying around here. This is some cold hard cash that is considered at the very least a barter currency, and I'm liable for the transactions that I'm doing. So they're going to start looking for ways to use Bitcoin in a more private way, and as you would use cash. And there's new technology that's coming out and being integrated now, particularly with open transactions. The Money Changer client is a system where you can take your dump with your Bitcoins and you can throw them into this, and they'll issue you digital cash tokens, like this digital cash that we've all been looking to play around with and stuff and use. And
the full anonymity version of digital cash.
Yeah, yeah. Right. The whole big dream of the past, fellow traveler, he's got it, and it's working. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not production quality, but he's got it, and it's doing it. It's issuing digital cash now. And one of his big projects that he's doing is integration with the Bitcoin system, because he sees that the biggest weakness of the digital cash systems is where do you keep your stash of gold that you have minted, these digital coins, the backing currency, you know,
it can
be seized in this. And he sees Bitcoin as being this excellent system for doing the backing to issue these tokens, the digital cash and vouchers and everything. So what you're going to start seeing is a lot more. You brought this up in one of your posts where you talked about how they talk about the amount of money that's being exchanged out there, but they don't show the private transactions happening within certain forex systems internally to those forex systems, or something. You know what?
Well, no, that's exactly it. I mean, you're talking essentially about how to construct a large scale anonymous Bitcoin transaction, or what I would like to call is a private value transfer, which sounds like something we should all have, right?
Uh-huh.
So, if you are talking about that, you already had one guest on one of your previous shows that is active in the laundries, which are basically Bitcoin mixers.
Right.
And if you are constructing a large, let's just take a hypothetical $100,000, €100,000 transaction that you'd like to do, I'm speaking about this, of course, as in a journalist capacity. They would most likely divide it up into several smaller transactions, and if they could use the mixers like that are provided now, or some of the online banks, or even MTGOX, you know, you're going to get different Bitcoin out than what you put in, and it's not really going to matter that the blockchain can be traced and you can follow every single coin to its origin, because it's going to be, that type of tracking is going to become irrelevant. And the reason is because I could transfer it to you in an offline manner. I can transfer a USB stick to you. I can give you my private key to unlock the wallet. So if you have a combination of offline transactions and online transactions, nobody's going to be able to piece together where all that came from. Mm-hmm. And so I think people miss that quite a bit on discussing it, is doing these offline transactions. And in a lot of ways, it's similar to how correspondent banking worked mm-hmm. back in the days when we had people like Deke Pereira, Deke International, doing the correspondent banking for foreign exchange or even Hawala. Is, you know, you give somebody money, and the money that comes out on the other end is coming from an entirely different place. So if for instance, if you and I wanted to transfer dollars to pound sterling, you know, you would go to somebody who has accounts in both, and they would take your dollars and they would give pound sterling out on the other end, but there would be no record of what happened in between, because they were done on just offsetting entity correspondent banking type transactions. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the traceability is there for the ones who are extremely uncareful. Like if you publish a donation public Bitcoin key on your blog, and that's the only receiving Bitcoin key that you use, of course you're going to see how many donations get, and you're going to also make the physical world identity link to the person who's running the blog, just like we could all check how many donations the EFF was getting. By doing a search on their key, those kinds of things that's just the fully traceable method of using Bitcoin. But there's no limit to how many receiving addresses you can create in your Bitcoin client. I mean, you can have a receiving address for every single person or transaction that you do.
Right.
So the linkage to the real world identity is going to become less and less important, especially for those who are savvy in how to construct those types of transactions.
Yeah. Well, then you take this a step further. Rather than just the system where you have this, you know, black box where something goes in and something goes out and it's unlinkable, is in that scenario, if it was just a simple in and out system where there's a mixing going on, the number of transactions that are actually taking place are still observable. But if you're talking about let's say a small town who would establish a community currency based on open transactions backed with Bitcoin, you could have, let's say, $100,000 worth of Bitcoins inside of storage backing a local currency that was doing anonymous digital cash exchanges all day long, where there could be $10 million worth of exchanges happening based on $100,000 just exchanging hands
many times
during a day, and those transactions would not be observable. So they're completely outside of the blockchain. So anyone who thinks that, well, we're still going to be able – we may not be able to tell who's doing what, but when there's big movements happening between this, we'll know that these particular parties, and then we can, you know, and then they try to think of these big schemes in order to attack certain parts of the system that they may see as weak. But I can see these alternate systems coming up where you do have huge numbers of people that are exchanging things back and forth with each other, where I don't want to send you a couple of Bitcoins. I'm going to send you some digital cash. And at any time, you can withdraw that and redeem it. But right now, I want to have finality of settlement, instantaneous. I want to send you. I don't have to wait 10 minutes for a transaction to take place. You know, we're the give one perfect example here. A lot of people have been looking what was the Mojo Nation and some of these other projects. We're working on adding financial incentives into P2P networks.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you try to do that right now, where you know, BitTorrent, you may be linked up with several hundred people exchanging stuff back and forth. And if you're sending micropayment bitcoins to these people, you're talking, what, 10 minutes now to truly verify very well that a transaction is final? No.
Approximately 10 minutes. Well,
yeah.
You'd be doing it on the Bitcoin network, yeah.
Yeah, no, the cost of doing these transactions, someone gave an estimate the other day of how much it cost, and I don't remember what it is, but these Bitcoin transactions are not free. Now, if you take a P2P system, a new BitTorrent client, and you say, we're going to integrate Bitcoin into it with open transactions into it, then what you have is you can take your Bitcoin, throw it into some digital cash in this system, and then you have these digital cash tokens that are flying all over the place, being settled instantaneously, exchanged back and forth, and it's completely outside of the Bitcoin system. And then, but at the moment that you may want to exchange out or throw money in, it happens at these borders. So I see this massive infrastructures happening that are extending Bitcoin into these alternate systems and above and beyond the Bitcoin network, but still using Bitcoin network as this, you know, as the proverbial, you know, Swiss vault, you know.
Yes. Yeah. No. I see that happening too, and that's precisely why I'm not that worried about the traceability features within Bitcoin, especially when you combine it with potential, you know, offline transactions and the things that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to actually worry about the traceability. It's a great, you know, it was necessary to achieve the decentralization. So,
yeah.
It's kind of one of those things. It's a trade-off. You either are centralized where you reissue against a mint, or you're decentralized where you're publishing, you know, a transaction blockchain.
Or
at this point, it's an either or until cryptography evolves, I guess, to the next level.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's either or, unless you take the best of both of them, like fellow travelers.
Right. Yes. Yep.
Combine them together, you know, kind of bring to the table the things that they both don't. We're running up on time here. I really hope to have you back, because it's been fascinating in this talk just to kind of shoot the bull on all these different topics. But there are a lot of very specific issues that we could do some shows on that are developing now and coming up in the future. But, you know, one thing I wanted to say is that people talking about, well, Bitcoin can fail and this type of thing. You know what? I heard this recently about some people talking about Ron Paul, and they said, you know what, it doesn't matter whether he gets elected, and it doesn't matter a lot of things about what's happening with him, because what they're excited about is what he has done to spread the message of freedom and liberty and acknowledging the growth of government and the state and the Patriot Act and the Federal Reserve, you know, bringing these ideas out, because no one in Washington, you know, he's got to be like one of the only guys, you know, in the entire Washington area who has been talking about many of these topics that he's talking about. So even if he fails and falls flat on his face without getting any type of election, the fact is, there's value in the awareness and the discussions and the ideas that are happening. And for me, what's happened with Bitcoin is worth that alone.
If
Bitcoin failed tomorrow, it has been a success, because for the first time, I mean, have you felt like John the Baptist in the past 10 years, sitting there like preaching in the wilderness about this stuff?
I've probably lost friends and family members because of it.
Right. Okay. So,
but yeah. It's like, you know, it's like PGP. It's not going to be put back in the bottle.
Right. And no one was talking about it, and now they are. So, you know, something happens bad with Bitcoin, and now more than ever are the minds and creativity and the incentives and everything out there are among masses of people to create an alternative system, or to just go ahead back to the drawing board. In a worst case scenario, they go back to the drawing board. They go back to using, thinking about using Loom and open transactions and having local mints and everybody minting their gold and their silver and alternative, and having 1,000 alternative currencies all interlinked and exchanged P2P Hawala type systems. And we move on from there. I mean, right. But at least people are talking about it and working on it and producing. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, thanks. Thanks for having your show. It's a great outlet. We didn't get a chance to talk about tax policy at all.
Well, let's see how much time we come up here. Well, we're at 109 right now.
Okay.
1 hour. And
no,
10
you're
minutes.
Fine.
I'm okay to, if you want to cover a couple of topics, I would love to. It's up to you with your time and your schedule.
Oh no, just briefly on the tax policy issue.
Yeah.
I think this will be very, very, very interesting to the agorist individuals out there. Is if you think about it, you know, we've all mentioned the size of the gray economy and the parallel economy and where Bitcoin's potential is, and everyone's very excited about it. I think that what you'll eventually see, though, is an inability to accurately ascertain income. And not just in the U.S., but worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And if it becomes more and more difficult to ascertain true income, because, you know, things just, you don't get a Bitcoin W-4, or a Bitcoin W-2,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to see the political environment shift towards more of a consumption-based tax or a headcount-type tax. I don't think that Bitcoin eliminates taxation, because taxation is through force. Bitcoin gives people the potential to live live a transaction private life, and where that can ultimately go, and this is what will be ultimately the turning point for Bitcoin, is like you mentioned, with checking on the markets and on the mark for what's on the Bitcoin mark. You know, to the extent that free individuals can earn Bitcoin and also spend that Bitcoin within the same Bitcoin economy, they will never have a need to transfer in and out, and therefore they'll never have a need to use an exchanger.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the people when your life gets to that point, which it isn't there yet, obviously, but you will be able to live an entirely a private financial life in terms of both your income and your spending, and it'll be untraceable to anyone except who you want to let know. Now, I mean, I guess people could see the things that you buy, and a lot of income tax sometimes is imputed on based on how much they see you spending. So if you're buying a Ferrari with your Bitcoin, there's going to be some questions there. But I just think that because of the way that income is determined, we're more likely to start seeing, unfortunately, consumption-based taxes like a VAT in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
or just a flat headcount. If they can't get you on other taxes, you know, everybody just pays a headcount tax just for existing.
Yeah, or what did they have in the U.S. originally? It was just a property tax, no?
A property tax based on property, but what do you do to the property-less people? I mean, the whole thing's an interesting question, and Bitcoin will have a very large impact on tax policy moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, if it does, what happens then with tax policy right now is that when you're punitive to one particular sector of the economy, the people don't just sit there and continue spending their money with the same patterns. And, you know, because the governments tend to look and say, well, if we tax this over the next 10 years, we are going to gain $20 trillion because we're going to get 50% of that money that is going in there now. But what happens is when they actually do that, the people see that as a punitive thing, and they adjust where they are spending their money. So if you're going to buy luxury items and you're going to give a 100% tax on yachts, but no tax at all on fancy cars, then a lot of times people will shy away from the yachts and throw their stuff into, I mean, it's kind of basic economic stuff. But how that applies with the markets in this realm is that if you do start taxing, if you can only tax, like, I'm going to tax ahead, and I'm going to tax the guys that are spending money here, and all this meat space stuff that you can sit there and you can really observe,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not just about where I may spend my money, because I'll think to myself, well, let's see, I could go down and I could order this thing and have it sent to my house, or go down to the local store and buy it in the meat space store and pay all these value-added tax and consumption and all this stuff on top of it, or I can barter with my neighbor. So the people can still do that. But then in this realm, what about investment money? If I find out that for every dollar that I invest as an entrepreneur into myself in the meat space economy, I'm getting screwed over by trying to, like, you know, compete in that market where I'm just getting screwed with all these taxes constantly. Whereas if I move into this other, what we're calling the second realm, I'm competing where in almost like in an offshore type thing, where if I put my investment into there, I mean, where's money? My point is, if you're looking at throwing money into a startup, are you going to throw it into a brick and mortar, or are you going to possibly look at throwing it into these businesses in the second realm, where whatever you throw into it is going to grow tax-free, it's going to multiply tax-free, and your earnings and the people that you pay, and, you know, the whole system, it could be a like a snowball, what do they call it, the snowball going down the mountain.
Right. You're going to be going where the most economic benefit is. So the second realm is like it's like Hong Kong in the early days, you know?
Right.
And it'll be something like that.
Now, how fast could that grow? That's my thing. Is that okay? We have it, but if it is that advantageous, give it 5 years, give it 10 years. How fast and how much is going to flow into that?
Well, okay. I think it's pretty fast, and maybe your radio program's having an impact, because Bitcoin has shot up to $13 while we've been talking.
All right. Oh, it's great. No, well, John, I want to tell you, thank you very much for your blog. Everybody, check out, give them the name of your blog, contact, any other contact information, and your Twitter feed before we go.
All right, sure. The blog is the Monetary Future. And it's themonetaryfuture.blogspot.com. We look at the future impacts that the changing currency is going to mean for free individuals. So we try to look out into the future, which is arriving so quickly now. The Twitter feed is more of a microblogging tool, and that one is twitter.com/JohnMatonis, JohnMatonis.
Yeah, great. I recommend everybody bookmark and follow his RSS feed on his blog. It's great stuff. But his Twitter feed is just, I mean, this thing is just chock full. If you're interested in these topics, his Twitter feed among all of them out there is one of the top ones that you have to have in there, because his stuff is pertinent. And it's not just talking about Bitcoin. He talks about, you know, central banks buying and selling gold and the whole monetary thing and economic stuff happening around the world. So that perspective is priceless. John, thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been a lot of fun talking with you, and hope to have you back soon.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the Second Realm, you are listening to AgoristRadio.com.